Welcome to Innovation and Leadership. I'm Jess Larson. Very excited to have repeat guest Walt Rakowich, author of Transfluence, host of the Off the Rack show, and former CEO of $50 billion Prologis REIT, and all-around high-integrity human being. And I'm glad he wanted to come back on the show. Walt, thanks for doing this.
Thanks for being back, Jack. Yes, you know, I just want you to know that in the last 3 years, Prologis has grown from $50 billion to $150 billion now. You can believe that. In the last 5 years.
Every time I'm in the country somewhere and I see Prologis on the side of some building, I always think of you.
Well, it is a great company. You know, I've been gone for 10 years now, so a long time. But I still know a lot of the people there and, you know, still keep up with them. And it's it really, really is a terrific company.
You know, I'm a big fan of your book, Transfluence. And obviously, when we had you on the show the first time, we got to talk a lot about, you know, the ups and downs and what happened and you leaving the company and then coming back as CEO and all these kind of things. And I think maybe to touch on that a bit, just for people who didn't catch the previous episodes, I would love to know, you know, 2008, the stock's down to, I think you could correct me. I thought you told me the market cap was like under a billion, maybe 500 million or something.
Oh yeah. $500 million. Yeah.
And
$2 a share is what that really equated to.
And so, and how long did it take you to get it from 500 million to 50 billion?
Boy, that took some time. I couldn't tell you the exact number of years that took, but at the time, we had gone from about a $25 billion equity market cap to 500 million, but the total market cap of the company was, with, you know, when you added up the debt, was about 50 billion, right? So if you took the total market cap, probably took us about 4 or 5 years. Yeah. And then we merged with another company and we became an $80 billion company when we merged. And then since that time, the company's grown since then.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, but it took some time and a lot of leadership challenges along the way, as you can imagine.
Yeah. It was so fun to talk about those on previous episodes. And obviously the book does a great job of it. And I've been bouncing around a little bit on your episodes of Off the Rack. And I like your conversations about humility and some of these things that you've had fun conversations about. I want to talk about this idea of, like, when you think about, you know, it's game time, right? You come back in, the stock's at $2 a share, you know, down to 500 million. I'm interested in what was going through your mind, knowing the challenge you were up against and knowing, you know, your future's not guaranteed.
I scared to death. You know, but it's so funny because you listen to leaders talk about, you know, the bravado and, you know, pumping themselves up and all that. The fact of the matter is I was scared. I was very nervous. You know, it was a moment, a challenging moment, and one that you'd never wish on anybody. But, you know, looking back on it, I think challenging moments, the most difficult times in your life is when you learn the most, and actually you're the least prepared. You know, you'd like to say, oh, I've turned around 5 or 6 companies since then, this will be a piece of cake, but it was my first, last, only. And, you know, and frankly, the company had been successful for 15 years leading up to that. I mean, we were really a darling on Wall Street. So when we pitched the company on Wall Street, everybody was interested in listening. It was a fun story. And I just had never been through, nor did I ever think that I would go through the time that we went through to turn around the company. And we were truly on the verge of bankruptcy, only a few months away, when the board asked me to come back and become the CEO. And I was nervous. I have to be honest. I was afraid. And I was really fortunate, Jess, that I had a terrific team. I had a CFO that was probably the best in the REIT business. And I had a chief investment officer that was definitely the best in the REIT business. And I had a general counsel that was the best in the REIT business. I mean, I didn't realize how good, but I knew I had a good team. Turns out now, looking back, I truly had one of the best teams in REIT land or in the real estate business. And so when you have a good team, and you're, you know, I don't think I needed to have all the solutions and the answers. I just think I needed to really engage them and rely on them and show them that I not only that I cared about them, but that I trusted. And I really felt that they were our solution. And I think at the end of the day, truly, they were the ones that put the plan together. I think don't get me wrong, I definitely had something to do with it, but truly my management team put the plan together and they executed it. Truly, they executed it flawlessly for about 2 years and it turned the company around. But if you ask, as you did, how did I feel? I was nervous. I didn't have all the answers. And day one, I didn't exactly know what we were going to do.
And so had they already gone through the merger and up to the $80 billion before you left, or was that after you left?
No, it was something that I engineered with another CEO. And then I stuck around for another year and a half after the merger was completed to make sure that the transition happened. And then I left after that.
So, Tell us about the wild ride from 500 million to 80 billion. What, like, for most people, this is experience we won't have. And, you know, we can imagine what the movie version of it's like. But what's an insight from it that you probably couldn't have gained other than living it?
You know, I write about this in my book. I definitely learned a lot in the process. And I would say there were probably in the beginning, there were a lot more down days than there were up days. Days that I went home and struggled and kind of in my own way prayed about. But what I learned along the way and I wrote about in my book is that I learned a lot about leadership. And leadership, I determined, was really more about everybody else, not me. And day one, it was kind of about me. But after that, it really became about just managing people and lifting them up and making them feel great about the things that they were doing every day and recognizing them. So the leadership principles kind of came alive to me. It was definitely a roller coaster ride on the financial side, no question about it. We, at the end of the day, if I had to put things into context, you know, if we owned, let's say, $50 billion in assets, roughly, we sold about $10 billion of those assets in 3 years and utilized a lot of the capital to pay down debt. And as we paid down debt, we essentially went back to our banks and were able to cut better deals with them, better covenants that then allowed us more runway before we blew those covenants, if you know what I mean. So we really had to have a chunk of cash in order to negotiate with our banks. And as we did it, we got stronger and stronger and stronger. And so I would say, you know, looking back on it, it probably took a good year until I felt like we had a real fighting chance to get out of it and not go bankrupt. And during that first year, I'm going to tell you, man, there were a lot of sleepless nights and I was just working dog years as my team was working dog years and truly wasn't 100% sure that we were going to get through it. So, you know, that's sort of a 30,000 foot version of it. But I learned a lot during it all. And as I mentioned to you before, you know, adversity is your best teacher and oftentimes is the best opportunity in your life. Even though you're not 100% sure when you're going through it that it's the best opportunity, for me, looking back on it now, it's something that I talk a lot about. I engage other people with. Here we are talking about it in a podcast. I would never have thought about that in 2008 and 2009, but now it's just a great lesson for me and for other people around me.
You know, I would love your thoughts. So you know, our little commercial real estate fund, we're getting into hospitality in a bigger way. We're building small resorts for action sports families near surfing beaches and snowboarding mountains and national parks and stuff like this. And we decided not to be like a buy and flip private equity group. We we're almost structured like a private REIT. Like we're a cash flow fund paying our investors a quarterly check. And when you when you look at the real estate world going forward and the uncertainty we're having right now with interest rates and over-leveraged people getting caught and things like that, as you look at the next decade, you know, if we wanted to be a $10 billion fund over time, what kind of advice would you have? Like starting today, knowing that this is the environment that we're headed into.
You know, the one thing I learned at Prologis, I'm not a big fan of leverage. I like leverage, don't get me wrong, but I like reasonable leverage. And I realized that we got out of, over our skis pretty rapidly. I mean, we were a pretty well-capitalized company, but in 1 or 2 years, we went from being a well-capitalized company to a lousy capitalized company. And I realized that debt, too much debt is a bad four-letter word. I hate to say it. And so as much as it can kind of moderate returns by not using leverage, I just believe that if you want to build something that is a cash flow cow and lasts for 20 to 30 years, you need to do it with a reasonable amount of leverage. And so that's the first thing that comes to my mind when you ask. I would probably put together a relatively low leverage fund. And
what's the range? What's the range for you between low leverage, then this range is medium leverage, that is high leverage, and then above that is just crazy?
Right. Okay. Well, that gets to my second point, and I'll answer that. As you probably know, I'm on the board of Host Hotels. You may not know that, but I'm on the board of directors of Host Hotels. So one thing I've learned about the hospitality business is the variability in cash flows is pretty substantial. It can be. Now, I don't know if that's exactly the business that you're in, but you know, in COVID, we went from a company that was 80% or actually our occupancies were even higher. Average occupancies in 2019 were higher than that. Let's just say between 80 and 90% to all of a sudden a company that was less than 10% occupied. Now that's draconian. Don't get me wrong. Very draconian. And obviously COVID was a draconian time, but nonetheless in the industrial business, you know, maybe we would go from 90% occupied or 93 to 85 or 86, but we had long-term leases and it took a long time to deteriorate that cash flow. In industrial, you can have much higher leverage levels. And still, to me, if you look at Prologis today, I don't know, they're probably a 40 or 50% levered company, which feels comfortable to me. But if you look at a hotel company, in my opinion, I'd be less than that. You know, I may be 25% or 30% leveraged if I was a REIT-like structure. Now, if I was a private equity fund and I was in and out and I wanted to, you know, I didn't have more than a 3-year hold period, I might think differently about it. But if I'm thinking long-term cash flows in the hospitality business, I'm definitely substantially less than 50% leveraged.
Just because we're so small right now, what we're trying to do is build these tiny house adventure cabins out of non-traditional materials and see if we can build like $120,000 cabin for 60 grand kind of thing by not using traditional labor and not using traditional materials and not take any leverage to begin with. And just until the recession happens or is over or feel like there's some sort of certainty, like we're kind of seeing like, can we provide an adequate return without any leverage in the early years and have that optionality later, but kind of have that extra safety day one is what we're leaning towards.
I'm kind of curious, what materials are you using to build these facilities?
So the main ones we're looking at is rammed earth aircrete and timber frame. But the way we're doing timber frame is we're actually logging ourselves. So we've got our own small sawmills and CNC machines. So instead of, you know, $30, $40 an hour labor to cut the notch in tenons, we're actually having, think like, are you familiar with CNC machines? Think like
no,
a reverse 3D printer. You put the plan into the computer, but instead of like building it up, it carves it down in. So we can carve, so we actually like bought custom parts from China and built our own 20-foot long one so we can put entire beams in it, kind of a thing. And so instead of, you know, $40 an hour skilled labor, you push, it's almost like pushing print on the computer, you know?
Wow, that's very interesting.
A lot of people don't know about Aircrete. It's popular for hurricane shelters, and it's quite popular in Europe, but American builders just have not embraced it. It's an aerated concrete. We actually like styro aircrete. So it's styrofoam and aerated concrete. It's like, think about like a 50-gallon drum full of shaving foam that you pour cement in and styrofoam in and stir it up. So it doesn't have the tensile strength of traditional concrete. You have to have rebar, but it is extremely insulative, fireproof, rodentproof, pestproof, and super cheap. And like, you can cut it with a drywall saw, and it's just a completely different material. So people can build hurricane shelters really fast. Like if you put it in a dome, it's incredibly strong. And so again, much more popular in Europe, hardly used at all here. And then in rammed earth, I mean, been around for thousands of years. Most of the Great Wall of China's, you know, lots of the Great Wall of China is built out of it. It's been used in cultures all over the world, but very labor intensive for the tamping. You're essentially, you take the dirt from your own lot, sift it, and put in about 7% Portland cement and a little bit of some clay. But, you know, it's mostly just 90% dirt from your own lot, right? And you tamp it with pneumatic tampers and basically turn it into rock. So it's barely damp. It's not wet. It's barely damp. But traditionally, very expensive, even with pneumatic tampers, let alone hand tampers. But even with pneumatic tampers, it's still quite labor intensive. So it doesn't end up cheaper than traditional construction. But there's been some new advances in robotics. And so we were actually trying to invent our own robotics technology to do rammed earth automated instead of labor. So we just do a lot of research of like, how do people build a house in Ghana or in Myanmar? And like, you know, we're super fascinated with the folks that are melting down water bottles and making bricks out of it and stuff like that. And so we're trying to take like, it's kind of like the Stanford University extreme affordability projects that Stanford runs. And we're just trying to research around the world of like, what if we forgot everything we knew about American construction and trying to, you know, what if we did it different? So
you ought to start talking to Prologis about how they build warehouses. No, I'm not kidding. I mean, the more I listen to you, the more I think that construction methods are going to change substantially, I think, in the next 10 or 20 years.
Well,
so,
who knows? That's what we're trying for, at least. And, you know, I guess a question is, like, when you look at interest rates where they're at, and, you know, I don't know if you follow Oak Tree's Howard Marks. Do you follow Howard Marks at all?
Yes. I wouldn't say I follow him, but I know of him.
So I'm a fan, you know, one of the few people, you know, I think you can count on one hand the people whose books Warren Buffett has endorsed. It's like his mentor, Ben Graham, Howard Marks, and basically nobody else, right? And he's been talking a lot about kind of like from 1980 to today, how interest rates were, you know, generally on a decline, and that people who are running their lives assuming interest rates are going back 0 to 2 in a long-term way, he feels like maybe that's not as realistic. And he feels like maybe this is a fundamental change to more moderate interest rates for the longer term. And, you know, maybe in the, you know, the 2 to 4 range for the basis that, you know, it's coming off of rather than 0 to 2. So I'd love to know if you agree or disagree. And secondly, if you do agree, how that would change how someone, you know, gets into a 30-year real estate business.
Yeah, I would tend to agree that we're going to be in a little bit higher interest rate environment, but I can tell you that every time that I've tried to predict, Jess, I've been wrong. So not every time, but a lot of times. I think you have to prepare for to be in a longer or a higher interest rate environment. But I do think that over time, what will happen if we are, is that things will adjust. You know, rents will adjust, construction costs will adjust. And right now they're out of kilter. I mean, it's very difficult to build anything in almost any product type except maybe data centers. that pencils. And the reason is because interest rates are high and construction costs are also high, and rents have not kept up. That's the bottom line. And so nobody, and you know, the returns that investors are looking for require those higher rents in order to make everything pencil, so very simply. So I think you have to assume that if demand is strong enough over time, and that's obviously an if, but or if or when it is, things will adjust. I can remember when I first got in the industrial business, I think cap rates were 8 or 9, a strong cap rate was an 8.5 to a 9. Strong. That's what assets sold at. And we were building at that point in time to 11 or 12. So therefore we had our 20 to 25% spread to what we could sell buildings at. Well, everything just simply adjusted down over time. And, you know, and that's, and so instead of selling it at an 8 or 8.5 or 9, we were selling assets at a 4 or 4.5, and we were building to a 6. Well, obviously you can't build to a 6 anymore today with interest rates at 6. So, so rents have to adjust over time. And, you know, one of the problems was that demand has kind of fallen off a little bit in most product types because interest rates are up. So, you know, we have to see all of that adjust and come back to equilibrium. And there's absolutely no reason why the real estate business or why we can't all exist in a higher interest rate environment. It's just right now it seems disoriented because rates have moved so quickly and everything else hasn't. And I do think that he's right. I find it really hard to believe that interest rates will go back down to 1 to 2%.
You do.
But I also don't think it's the end of the world is my point. I do think there'll be some dislocation in the meantime. I think, you know, in the office market, perhaps in the residential market, although less so, but I think there'll be some dislocation in valuations, maybe even in the industrial market. But I think at the end of the day, it will work out. And in 3 or 4 or 5 years from now, we'll say, well, we're just simply in this new environment. Yeah. That's all. And everything's a jam.
You know, I'm interested. Who do you feel like are some of the greatest minds in, you know, large, the real estate world in general, but specifically large portfolio real estate these days?
Wow, it's great. That's a really great question. I think it's somewhat product type specific. I always used to think Sam Zell was a great real estate mind, and he's passed away. I don't know. That's a really good question. I guess you could say Blackstone. But you know, they've had their challenges too. But in terms of large portfolios, let's face it, there's Blackstone and there's Blackstone. I mean, you know, and so they're out there. Obviously, within the industrial realm, there's Prologis and there's specific companies. But I think, you know, real estate has always been a fairly fragmented business with a lot of large deals happening with a lot of players that, you know, seem to emerge. And then, you know, 10 years later, they have different business cards, you know. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of players. And by the way, very few companies are making any deals today, as you know, because as there is disconnect on the development side, there's also disconnect on the acquisition side. Acquisitions don't make any sense. I'm on 3 REIT boards.
Which ones?
And all 3 of those. Well, I'm on Host Hotels. I'm on Iron Mountain, which, you know, is a REIT, but doesn't act like a REIT. They're more of a service company, but nonetheless, they're a REIT. And Ventas. And I would say all 3 companies, except for Iron Mountain, because Iron Mountain's in the data center business. The other 2 REITs, you know, their acquisition business last year was probably at an all-time low in the last 10 years. I mean, they just aren't doing anything. And they're moving into 2024, kind of saying the same thing. I think they'd like to be out and be more active. But as long as interest rates are as high as they are, it's hard to find deals that make any sense.
Yeah. Let's go the other end. Instead of the large portfolio owning billions, let's talk about the individual investor. You know, I had Michael Sonnenfeld on here who runs Tiger 21. And for people not familiar, it's like, I can't remember how many members it is. I want to say it's about 140 members and about $140 billion across them. So something like, it's very high net worth people. Okay. Kind of, it's like 10 million and up, but most, okay. I think my math is off. I think his members average 100 million net worth between the people at 10 million and the people at billion. Okay. So they get together in these groups of 12.
Yes.
And every month somebody, so they sign all these non-disclosures, and every month you defend your portfolio and you share these other 11 people, like everything you've got everywhere. And you have to defend why you have what you have. And it's a lot of like, you know, former entrepreneurs, former executives who are now managing their own money, right? And it's like full transparency and they get really close, but they publish an annual report every year of, you know, all these people with this averagely $100 million net worth, what do they own? What percent equities, what percent bonds, what percent alternatives? And they even separate real estate out from alternatives. And like year after year, it's always 20, 30% in real estate at the end of it. In
real
the individual
estate.
Level. Yeah. So
no kidding. That's
so
amazing.
I'm interested in your thoughts of why. I mean, we probably all have opinions, but I'm interested in your opinions on why for decades and decades, so many individual investors have also been so reliant on real estate as a personal investment.
Well, I am a believer in hard assets. I'm not a big believer in holding the dollar. And I think that a hedge against that are stocks, obviously, over time. But I think real estate has provided a great hedge. I mean, you know, basically all the currencies throughout the world have, you know, kind of devalued over time relative to real estate. They really have. And so I like my personal opinion, and it's just me, but I like holding hard assets. That, you know, you wake up every morning, you kind of still see them. And so if I had the choice between a hard asset and holding a dollar, I'd take the hard asset. As long as the hard asset was a good asset, yeah. You know, they're good and bad. So, you know, I'm not surprised by that. You know, you look at, folks like Michael Dell who are out there in the hospitality space and owns a lot of Four Seasons, owns a lot of hotels personally.
Bill Gates.
And
Bill Gates, family office, Cascade, owns tons, right?
Absolutely. And I think I personally believe there's an element to that, which is just to say, I think it's a great hedge against currency devaluation over time. And I think they've proven to be right. Now, we've been in an interest rate environment that has gone down and down and down and down and down over time. So it will be interesting to see what happens to real estate in the course of the next 10 years or so if interest rates do reset. Perhaps there's a pause. I don't know. But I feel good about hard assets. And I feel especially good about, you know, certain types of hard assets that I'm comfortable with, like industrial assets. Now, if you ask me if I own any individually, I would tell you no, notwithstanding that comment.
Well, and especially where you truly understand the ins and outs of how large portfolios work and you know the people running them, you know, as Warren Buffett would say, it's in your circle of competence to value those.
It is. And I'm, you know, I sold on Wall Street for years and years and years, the REIT business. And I really do believe that, you know, these companies today are different than public real estate companies 20 and 30 years ago. I think they own the best of the best assets, most of them, or the best quality REITs, if you will, own the best of the best assets. And they are professional management teams. They're not entrepreneurs that figured out a way of taking their companies public for tax purposes to defer taxes. These are now professional management teams that understand how to run real estate. And I feel very comfortable buying REIT stocks because if you look through REIT stocks, they are effectively owning the real estate. They are, you know, whatever happens to your real estate valuation over time is what's going to happen to your stock.
Let's switch gears a bit. You're a podcaster. Tell me about Off the Rack and what you've enjoyed about it.
You know what, Jess, when I retired, and this has been now 10 years ago, I had this epiphany that the last third of my life would be devoted to just trying to make a difference in the world, in the lives of a lot of different people, but whoever wanted to listen. And so I sort of charted a course as to what that meant. And as you know, I wrote a book 3 years ago about leadership. And after I wrote the book, I started getting involved with podcasts. I obviously did a podcast with you a couple of years ago, and that was a lot of fun. We did a few of them, and I started having fun doing that. But I thought, well, maybe I think I'd like to bring some leaders on as well, interview them, and get a message out into the world about what good leadership is. I do a number of other things, but that to me is sort of my answer to how I give back to the business community for the most part. And so we started Off the Rack. We're now in our third season. I have interviewed some really unbelievable leaders. I had the former CEO of Walmart on last year. We had the former president of Starbucks on last year. Tomorrow I interview Chester Elton. I don't know if you know of Chester, but he's a prolific business author that wrote The Carrot Principle. And I think he sold three and a half million copies, something like that. Amazing, amazing author. A sort of cultural expert that talks about recognition in the workplace. I'm going to have Mike Nolan next month on, who is the former San Francisco 49ers.
Oh, fun.
And then the following month, I have Stacey Lewis on just before the Masters. Stacey's won nine times on the LPGA Tour. So it's been fun having leaders on. And I choose leaders that I believe have a real heart in the things that they do, lead with humility, led whether they be in sports or in business, have led in a humble and honest and, you know, high integrity way. And it's really been fun. I've enjoyed getting to know these people, but I've really enjoyed getting a message out, I think like you do, in the marketplace. And I feel like, you know, I hope that at least that's impactful in the lives of the people who
listen.
That's
so fun. You know, my other company, Greystoke Networks, where we make shows for CEOs, and we, you know, we line up all the fancy guests and do all the coordinating, and they just show up for the interview, and then we edit and cut the social media clips and stuff, right? We have a new interest, because I mean, so I'm in, like, I don't know if I told you this, I'm between 900 and 1,000 episodes now of mine. And so, you know, a couple of years ago is when I thought, like, why doesn't every CEO want to have one of these? Like, it's like pushing the easy button to meet all these like great people you wish you knew and connect with hard to reach decision makers, and it's just fun,
right?
You know, and so we keep getting all these clients, these CEOs who are like kind of like you said, like, oh, that's actually fun, and like it's a way to both meet interesting people and raise the profile of the business by getting people interested in me, and then they get interested in the company, kind of a thing, but also share their decades of experience in this conversation with the guest, right? So I know there's other CEOs who, like, they just don't get it, right? Or they're they like the idea, but they're hesitant. So in your mind, you know, you look like, you know, who's the guy that runs the $1 trillion sovereign wealth fund for Norway? Starts with a T. Dang it. Anyways, he's got a great show. David Rubenstein's show on Bloomberg, right? In your mind, why, like, an active CEO, obviously for some it doesn't make sense, but for the ones it does, in your mind, what would be their advantages if there's somebody's on the fence?
It's interesting you'd say that, because I think about the time when I was a CEO, and I hate to say this, but in some respects, the things that you do, at least back then, were somewhat ruled by your public relations department, and they and our PR department didn't want me to have be on so didn't want me to be on social media, didn't want me to do any interviews outside of, you know, kind of selling the stock. I shouldn't say that. From time to time, I was on CNN and CNBC, and but to do a podcast with somebody out of the blue would be like, nah, that's not, you know, we don't see how that benefits us, and, you know, so forth and so on. So I, and also your time, how does it benefit? I think it does help. It depends on the listeners. It depends on the, you know, the interest of the listeners. In my case with Off the Rack, I'm trying to reach people just in an altruistic way to try to get them to understand what good leadership looks like. And so that's not that threatening, I think, to a CEO, but I think it depends on the leader, or excuse me, the people that are listening in, and what they're up to. And unfortunately, a CEO that is running a public company, you got to be really careful about the things that you say. There's non-public information that could slip out. And there's just almost more downside than there is upside. I could see that my general counsel was just like, no, Walt, that's not something I want you to do. So I just think there's downside to doing it. I tend to find that I get a lot of retired CEOs that want to do it, because then at that point in time, all they're doing is imparting wisdom on people. They don't have any downside. They could say anything, and it's fine. So yeah, I think it just depends on where you are.
Well, it is certainly the argument for not having a live show, right? I will say this. When we get, you know, CEOs or senior execs, like C-suite execs from public companies as guests on my show, there is definitely the like, hey, don't worry, you can review this. And if you want anything edited out, right, we'll do that. And like, same thing for like guys from the, you know, spent time in the classified units of special operations or the intelligence community, we'll get a call back the next day. Hey, listen,
right,
I realize I don't think I was supposed to let anyone know I was in that country. Can you take that back out? You know? And we have to do that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Like I said, I think there is downside. And I can understand why people would want to pass on that.
But here's my question.
Know, it's not,
because it really, I'm totally with you. And especially for folks that, you know, didn't grow up with it like this, and the way communications have changed over the last 10 and 20 years, right? They're even less comfortable, right? My question for you is, the ones that are deciding to do it, what do you think the advantages are?
Well, I think they're doing it to, you know, obviously to get a message out there, right? And the more people that they reach, especially if they're public companies, the more people they reach, the more people potentially could buy their stock, the more customers. I mean, it's a customer facing thing too, right? And so if they can reach customers and get their message out, perhaps even increase sales. I don't know. I never did it. But you know, those would be the things that kind of come across to me. I'm sure that there, you know, there could be upside to people, but you know, you just have to be really careful. That's
well,
all.
Tell us one or two of your favorite guests from Off the Rack.
Wow. I've had a number of them. I have to admit that when Mike Duke came on and he was the CEO of Walmart, he had some absolutely terrific stories to tell. Last year we had Neil Epperson on, who is the head of psychology at the Anschutz Medical Center. And she talked about mental health in the workplace, which I found very interesting. I think it's a troubling, in some respects, it's a troubling trend that's happening more and more in the workplace today. And I found it very interesting talking about, you know, some of the things that certain employers were inquiring about and how they could, you know, utilize the Johnson Depression Center at CU to, you know, help them through some of their issues. So that was really interesting. So those are just, you know, two that come to mind.
No, that's great. Well, I want to switch back to a couple more real estate questions before I let you go. So thinking about what makes a world-class chief investment officer, in your mind, what are some of those characteristics? Why did you feel like you had one of the best in the industry?
Wow, that's a really great question. He was an amazing deal guy. I mean, he was just an amazing deal guy. And he would be the first to say that he hated to manage people, absolutely hated it. And, you know, he only did it because he absolutely had to. But my God, if you put him in front of anybody, I mean, he could just, and when I talk about negotiating deals, I think that the people that understand risk and understand how to push risk, but only to a point, but always covering themselves on the risk side, and never getting too far out ahead of themselves from a risk perspective, he just did an amazing job. I knew when he negotiated the deal, not only was it the best deal that we could ever put together, but I also knew that we had no downside or very little downside. He was just absolutely fabulous at that. And let me tell you, when we were going through 2008 and trying to negotiate with our banks and trying to negotiate with our customers and our venture partners, having a guy like that was incredibly invaluable to us. And in some respects, the combination of he plus our CFO really kept us out of bankruptcy because of their ability to negotiate deals and actually keep our risk profile as low as possible in doing so.
In your mind, besides too much leverage, what are the main kinds of risks that he needed to avoid?
In our case, we had structured deals whereby private equity funds were required to buy assets from us at certain prices. And those funds, whenever valuations sunk, those funds were balking at buying assets from us because they had to buy assets from us at appraised value. Well, appraised values had plummeted. Values had plummeted, but appraised values had not plummeted. And so they were required to buy assets from us at prices that were substantially above where the likelihood is that assets would start trading. But we needed cash. And so, you know, you could say, okay, we're going to take these guys to court and we're going to sue them. And they're going to need to pay us X amount of money, but it could take several years to do. Or we can just figure out the right, you know, the right price to sell our assets at, perhaps above where the assets are truly going to trade in the future, but someplace in between where appraised value was and that value. And that's no man's land. Who knows what that valuation is? And so he was really terrific at, you know, just making people feel comfortable with the deal that they got and the deal that we got, which was someplace in between. And the risk was that he doesn't, you know, that he pounds the table and walks away, doesn't cut any deal, and we get no cash in the door, and potentially we go bankrupt. And so, you know, that's sort of the give and take, and he was terrific at it.
Okay, we'll go quicker on the next two. What made a world-class CFO for real estate for a REIT?
Well, you know, when you're over leveraged and you're on the verge of bankruptcy, having a world-class CFO is one that has tremendous relationships with bankers, creates a tremendous amount of trust in the banking community, and ultimately does what he says he's going to do and doesn't get too far out over his or her skis in terms of promising certain things to your bankers that they can't do. And so my CFO was really, really good at knowing how far to push the bankers, but you know, only to a point where we could get a certain amount and then backing off from there. And also I would say that over time, he embodied a tremendous amount of trust in it with his team. The CFO of most companies run the largest part of the company. In the case of REITs, over 50% of the company reports indirectly or directly into the CFO. And so ultimately, he needed to embody a tremendous amount of trust with our people as well. And he did that over time too.
Okay. Last one. I feel like we should, okay. I wish we had more time because you said a lot of great things in there I want to go over. But world-class general counsel for an income-based real estate business.
You know, I got to just tell you, we went through 3 years of staving off bankruptcy, Jess, and we never got sued once. Never got sued. Not once. By a shareholder, by a bank, by some, extraneous, by a hedge fund that was out there that was trying to take advantage of the situation. We did not get sued one time. And I think it boils down to tremendous transparency. We had an amazing amount of transparency in the marketplace. We did everything we said we were going to do, and our general counsel embodied that as well. So, I mean, it's all the things I talk about in Transfluence, transparency and humility in terms of dealing with your people and integrity and honesty. And at the end of the day, we kept our people as well. And that boils down to humanness. I mean, we were just human around our people and transparent with them. And so somehow, some way, we cobbled together 2 or 3 years. We did not go bankrupt. And at the end of the day, now you look at Prologis, one of the strongest companies in the S&P 500. And it's just an amazing story. And so I would just say, everybody, go out and learn something about the company. It's a great story.
Oh, so great. Well, listen, I really appreciate you making the time to come back on the show.
Oh, it's my pleasure. It's so much fun to come back on. And I really enjoyed being with
great.
You. And I wish you the best in 2024.
You too. Okay, bye, everyone.